This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is away, so we've got a great panel for you, which includes Daniela Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Current. Hello there, Daniela.
Hi.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Always happy to be here.
And Kevin Rennie. He's a lawyer. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at dailyructions.com. Hello there, Kevin.
Good morning.
So let's start with the strangest and, I guess, biggest political story in the state from the past week. At a political event in Avon, Mayor Mark Boughton collapsed. Our NBC buddy Max Reese picks up the story from there.
Boughton's campaign manager caught him when he started to fall to the floor, and State Representative Prasad Srinivasan attempted CPR, but according to Boughton, chest compressions were never fully administered.
I had a blockage in my airway, so once the doctors moved my head to get air into my lungs, I took a big gasp, and my pulse resumed pretty strong.
So that's Mark Boughton, Paz. He's the mayor of Danbury, running once again to be governor. I'll start with you and Danielle, and just let's set the scene a little bit. So what do we know? Mark Boughton, who has had operations for a benign brain tumor in the past.
He had an operation in August to remove a cyst that was described the size of a lemon.
So it's a pretty good size cyst.
It's a good size cyst. And, you know, the mayor actually made a commercial for the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, which ran during the Super Bowl. Which was a very well done, very moving commercial. And it seemed like, okay, this is going to be part of his narrative. I looked face in the eye and I'm back. And, yeah. You know, and the incident Thursday night and the response to it raises, you know, some serious concerns. And the foremost, obviously, is the health concern. Secondly, is the initial inability of his campaign to address it, which seems to indicate that they're relying on their candidate perhaps to help run the campaign, because they really had not much to say for the first 18 hours. They put out a statement from the University of Connecticut Health Center where he was taken that said he was treated for dehydration, which I have no doubt is completely accurate, but not the complete story. So I got Boughton on the phone eventually Friday. I didn't realize at the time I was the only one who managed to get him. But Boughton then did what you're supposed to do. He was very open. He said, yes, it was a seizure. It was severe. It was scary. I asked him about the meds he was supposed to be taking, and he said, yes, he was prescribed anti-seizure meds after his surgery and no doubt did not take at least the evening dose. You're supposed to take these twice a day. So now the question is, going forward, how does he convince people he's healthy enough to continue? And of course, there was this match going on. It's a type of match that's difficult for people who are severely dehydrated to engage in between him and Dr. Srinivasan about what exactly happened.
Well, yeah, and I want to get to that in a second, because the other candidate's response to this is unusual. But this health concern is something that we knew that Boughton would have as he enters this governor's race, Daniela, and now we have something happen on the campaign trail that maybe isn't directly related to it. Dehydration happens to a lot of people, but it certainly does raise some questions.
Yeah, it was a very visible incident in front of, you know, more than 200 people at a crowded campaign event, 200, you know, Republican activists, insiders, and other candidates. So, you know, in a crowded field for governor, the Republican race is a very crowded field. Candidates are going to use this as a wedge issue. I mean, you know, I guess yesterday Dave Walker was out there. You know, we have questions about Mark Boughton's health. So it's all they need to sort of, you know, draw a question in the minds of some, you know, would-be delegates to say, look, you know, is this guy fit for office? This is now, you know, become an issue for them.
Later on in the program, Kevin, we're going to talk about another candidate sort of taking what you and many people believe are unethical jabs at Governor Malloy for stuff. You know, there's certain lines maybe we shouldn't cross in campaigns. What about the line of someone is running for governor who has had some health concerns in the past, and now we want to either publicly or behind the scenes talk about whether or not that makes him a good candidate for governor?
I thought he handled his surgery last summer beautifully. Was very straightforward about it, and sort of followed his recovery. So that the mess that they made of this the other night was really a big surprise. And talking to people who were there that evening, it was pretty harrowing. And to try to just sort of minimize it as dehydration. Look, there were a lot of candidate forums. There have been a lot of races for governor. This is the first time anyone can remember a candidate collapsing in front of them and turning an unusual color. Mm. So this was not an ordinary evening on the campaign trail. And to sort of minimize it as dehydration, I think, didn't reflect very well on the Boughton campaign.
Well, and before I get to Paz's quick response, though, maybe not minimize it as dehydration, but how much do you think other candidates are served by drawing attention to someone else's health issue? Well, I mean, does it really help you at all to say, this guy maybe isn't up for it?
I mean, people don't need a candidate to draw attention to it. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody has their own sort of, you know, philosophy of, I think, sort of an informal notion of where the line is on candidates' health. It's just we don't have to use it very often. I do think Dr. Srinivasan engaged in some oversharing of what happened. If he was acting as a doctor, I think there were all sorts of HIPAA violations going on there in Avon, and he just couldn't help himself. I don't think an allergist gets an opportunity very often to run to the scene of what looks like a pretty serious situation.
Well, then let's talk through the response, the medical response, which has turned in Paz and Daniela to a political response as well from Dr. Srinivasan. I mean, what exactly happened? I mean, it seems as though if there's a seizure, first of all, the little that I know about this, CPR isn't normally what one would perform. Mark Boughton says, well, CPR wasn't really performed on me anyway. I mean, what do we know about this actual response?
Well, we know a couple of things. One, the CDC's protocols are quite clear that CPR is not what you do. Now, in defense of Dr. Srinivasan and the other doctors who were there, how clear was it exactly what was happening? Witnesses described Mayor Boughton as turning blue, in Srinivasan's words, bluer than blue. So the idea that they were beginning some type of resuscitation is certainly, I would not call that irresponsible. Now, the problem is not Boughton, but some of Boughton's supporters have pushed back and they have suggested that Srinivasan perhaps acted improperly, both as a question of how he shared material, shared information about what happened, including talking about the pills that were found in the anti-seizure pills that were found in the mayor's pockets and whatnot. So there's some confusion. The guy drops down. I think people can understand that. But why this became into this back and forth, it does not serve Srinivasan well. It does not serve Boughton well. And again, in Boughton's defense, he has not directly done that. In fact, he embraced Srinivasan the other night. Boughton understands he needs now to reassure people of his health. And also, it's the teachable moment about seizures. How debilitating are they? The Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court has had two seizures in his adult life. He was criticized for not being more forthcoming, not because of his inability to do the job, but because this is an area of a lot of uncertainty. And again, it's the teachable moment. So Mark Boughton is going to have to do that. And he's thinking of early as Tuesday of having at least his primary care physician available and to begin to do this kind of thing.
But amongst the various responses, though, and I'm reading here from Paz's story in the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela, quoting, I believe, Dr. Srinivasan saying, "Our businesses have no life at all, as if that life was being sucked away. Our businesses are dehydrated, and we need to make sure we take care of them." I think that the colloquial term "too soon" might indeed apply here. I mean, he's really talking like that after helping to save a guy's life?
So that was an awkward moment. Srinivasan, Boughton, and
that was
several
a surreal
other
moment, let's be honest.
Were addressing the Republicans in West Hartford. And after Boughton left, Srinivasan went on this thing. And we both asked him and another reporter as well. We followed Dr. Representative Srinivasan into the hallway. And we asked him, you know, what did you mean by that? He's clearly pissed that people like Senator McLaughlin are, you know, painting him as, who wasn't there, are painting him as alarmist and, as you know, as was suggested, maybe oversharing a moment that perhaps he shouldn't. On the other hand, you know, Dr. Srinivasan is an allergist, so you know it's perhaps correct that he doesn't get to you know perform this type of life-saving you know maneuvers that frequently. But the other doctor that was there were actually three doctors there, but one of the other doctors, the main guy who was working on Boughton, is an anesthesiologist at St. Francis, and you know
that's
we spoke.
What you want. That's what
yeah,
you want
we
there.
We
yeah.
spoke with the guy. He didn't want his name in the paper, but he was the one that, you know, cleared his airway, you know, immediately. I mean, he was yelling for masks. They were yelling for a defibrillator because, again, the guy drops down, as Paz pointed out. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody, you know, you don't know. Is it a seizure? Is it a heart attack? Is it, a you know, some other medical emergency? Nobody knows. I mean, even doctors, you can't assess that quickly. So they immediately began to work on the patient. And while Srinivasan was working to get him ready for CPR, in terms of, you know, the chest portion of it, the other guy, the anesthesiologist, was working to clear his airway because clearly, I mean, Boughton even said he bit his tongue. You know, his airway was blocked and he wasn't getting oxygen, and that hence the bluish color. So that's, you know, that's kind of what happened. And now Srinivasan is seeing people questioning his handling of it, and he's kind of striking back in a very sort of a little bit surreal and bizarre way.
It was passive aggressive.
He's a little petulant.
Well,
gets more attention than he's gotten in a year on the campaign trail, and suddenly he's unhappy about it.
Since we have a lawyer here, Kevin, I'll just ask you. I mean, you brought up HIPAA violations. I guess I just wonder, something like this happens, and you're a doctor, and you're part of a group that is attending to someone who's fallen down. I mean, what are you supposed to do as far as publicly talking about what's in their pocket, about their medication, what exactly the diagnosis of this person was? I don't know. Are we supposed to be saying this to the press?
I don't think you're supposed to be talking about those things, and particularly without speaking with the patient or their or members of their family. I just thought he went on at some length. Although, in the sweepstakes of who is the most inappropriate, David Walker saying it put a damper on the evening, I think, was a serious contender for nitwit of the night.
my sense is it probably, Paz, did put a bit of a damper on
that
the evening.
That was Kevin Rennie just speaking, ladies and gentlemen, by the way.
But, you know, people who were there,
yeah.
I spoke to two of them that night. It was really a harrowing scene.
It was very scary.
You know, think about it. We're all of a certain mature age. How often have you seen someone collapse at all? It's not very often.
Well, I will just say, and I'm saying this because he's been putting it out on Twitter, your former colleague, Paz, Ariel Levin Becker, put out a very nice series of tweets that I shared this past week describing a lot about what we know and don't know about how to treat people with seizures. Aaron Tucker Ives, who formerly produced this program, had one in the newsroom. And we had to attend to it. And I can say it is a very, very, very scary scene. And I will just quickly say on behalf of all of us, and certainly Colin McEnroe, who's expressed this publicly as well, we're just glad that Mayor Mark is okay. And we're able to talk about some political stuff with him, hopefully in the future, as opposed to medical stuff. Let's continue on with another big story that came out of the governor's race this week, also on the GOP side. New Britain Mayor Erin Stewart declared Monday she's no longer just exploring a run, but is officially seeking the position in earnest.
If you're looking for a candidate that's going to fit within a certain ideology, I'm probably not the candidate you're looking for. I'm okay with that.
Okay, so Paz, she said, it's time for my generation, and as we've suggested here, her generation is a different generation than those of us of a mature age. She's 31 years old. It's time for my generation to step up, she says.
She's not quite 31. She turns 31 in May, to be accurate. Yes.
Well, so she's almost 31 yes. years old. She'd be 31 as governor, and she's officially stepping into this. So what is different about Erin Stewart from these others?
There's a lot that's different. She has one of the most engaging personalities in politics. There's a certain joyousness about her that people find very attractive. Now, the flip side is she at times seems to show this immature streak. And at her press conference afterwards, you know, there's no other way to say it. She has this habit of giggling at times and giving answers. And that's a difficult thing. You know, you try to address this in a way that doesn't come across as sexist or patronizing, but it's a thing. On the other hand, people find that she really has incredible retail political skills. You know, I was talking to a Democrat who's not one of the people competing against her, but had that reaction that there seems to be an immature streak, but he has been advised by people who know her, you underestimate her at your peril. And I think those things are not mutually exclusive. So, but one of the things that, again, one of the downsides the other day when she announced, we were asking her about whether or not she joins other Republicans in looking to really restrict what you can do for public employees through collective bargaining, such as retiree health and pensions, which has become obviously a big thing. She punted a little bit on that issue, saying she needs to do more research. And then she started laughing and talked about her great uncle being the author of collective bargaining laws. And she was referring to Dominic Bartolotto, who ran AFSCME in New Britain for a long, long time, and he served in the legislature. And indeed, he was a major player in writing laws that give public sector employees the rights to have contracts settled by binding arbitration, collective bargaining. So that's a long-winded way of saying that, you know, Aaron's kind of a mixed bag for Republicans. There's a freshness there. There's an excitement, but there's some downsides.
Yeah, I don't know, Danielle. Luckily, there are no current Republican politicians who are prominent who are in their 70s who periodically show a lack of maturity. I mean, we can't name any of them at all, I'm sure. So Aaron Stewart, maybe a little bit immature. I mean, is that her biggest issue as a candidate?
Well, I didn't cover her announcement on Monday, so I wasn't there for that. But, you know, I do think, you know, she clearly stands out in a field of, you know, older white men. She stands out for a lot of reasons that Paz just outlined. I mean, she's talked sort of openly about the things that she's experienced. You know, people point out her giggling. People point out her, you know, her on AM talk radio, which, of course, we're not on right now. They you know,
that make still exists.
I know you guys are killing them, but but they
unfriendly jab on my part. Please continue.
They you know, the callers generally, I guess their demographic is probably the older white male crowd, tend to be more conservative, make fun of her voice. You know, she's talked about that. People make fun of, you know, things she's done in her past. And, you know, look, are those liabilities any more than, you know, the sort of dour looks that the gray beards of the party project? I mean, you know, we were just talking about David Walker. You know, David Walker at one point tweeted that, you know, the next governor of Connecticut needs to be a father, a grandfather. Yes. You know, obviously Aaron Stewart is none of those things. I mean, but, you know, who's to say that that's the correct persona that the governor needs to inhabit? I mean, you know.
Hell of a week for David Walker, Kevin. But, I mean, I don't know. You know, Paz and Danielle both touch on something, which is it has worked in Connecticut politics before. Jody Rell was a very popular governor, and she was very likable, and people really liked her. And the idea that in a world where there's a bunch of people who are the same and maybe don't stand out, and many people who, for whatever reason, are kind of unlikable, having somebody who's likable isn't such a bad thing, is it?
Well, it does. You know, it does. It can set you apart from this crowded field. I would say this: she has this in common with a lot of the other candidates, which is she appears to have no ideas about what to do about Connecticut's troubles, and that is true of Republicans and Democrats. We're in March. No one is really saying if 10 months from now, I'm the governor of Connecticut and I'm facing a $4 billion deficit, here's what I would do. They will talk about anything but that. I would be surprised if Aaron Stewart has a plan.
You've run political campaigns and advised political campaigns before. I mean, what would you have them saying right now, especially with this very big field, when you're still looking to try to differentiate yourself within a Republican Party that's going to go to a convention and probably have a primary as well? I mean, what exactly do you say right now in terms of ideas and specifics?
Well, it's, you know, you're right now, the candidates are appealing to a very small number of people. Their targets are donors, and Aaron Stewart's getting a really late start on that to raise $250,000 in small contributions, and then the delegates who are about to be picked. So we're just, their audience is a few thousand people, and those people are much more engaged than the general public. I think they're interested in ideas. I think they can tell them, look, this is going to be very painful, but here's what I would do, and here's the result that I see. I do think you can dive into more details with the audience right now that you need to seek.
There was a forum last night in Glastonbury for Republicans, which I didn't file a story, but I did go out there and sat through the hour and a half. And Erin Stewart, it was the first opportunity for her to sort of be on stage and mix it up. And I don't know, I tried to reach her. I don't know, you know, why she didn't attend, but there were 9 Republicans there. The trick for Mayor Stewart and the others is to give Connecticut voters a sense that, yes, they have an idea, they may have a plan. The trick is, though, not to be so specific that you scare the hell out of people, because any way you're going to address a deficit of the size that Kevin just did, you're going to hurt people. You're going to either raise revenue, cut services, or do some combination of both. And that is hard thing to honestly address while you're campaigning.
It is, but it has to be done. I mean, they have to face it. Whoever wins has to face it, but they can't say, "Oh, I didn't know it was this bad."
But
we're telling them how bad it is.
I don't know. I mean, if part of the process right now, Daniela, is all these town, these forums, and these meet and greets, and these town committee meetings. I mean, aren't rank and file Republicans who are out there looking for a gubernatorial candidate, aren't they asking them these questions? I assume that people do want to hear some of these details. So aren't they grilling them on, be specific, what are you going to do about this?
Yeah, they are. I mean, even the other night in West Hartford, you know, before Dr. Srinivasan gave his assessment of the patient that is Connecticut, he and the other candidates were all asked, you know, where do you stand on CBEC? You know, how did you vote on the budget, or what did you think about the budget? I mean, so they were being pressed. I mean, you know, they are talking in generalities. That is true. And maybe that's just the strategy that they're trying to carve out.
It just occurred to me why they're not giving a plan. It's because Connecticut is a patient, and that would be a HIPAA violation.
Oh, that's what it is. You can't talk. Yeah, you actually can't diagnose on the campaign.
We'll sign a release.
Okay. Kevin Rennie is a lawyer, Hartford Courant columnist, blogs at dailyructions.com. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Daniela Altamari, State House reporter at the Hartford Courant. If you want to join our conversation, we're going to continue with some gubernatorial politics. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, which is right now about gubernatorial politics, at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Also 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're joined today by Kevin Rennie from DailyRuctions.com and The Hartford Courant, The Hartford Courant's Daniela Altamari, and also Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Quickly, as we go through some news about GOP candidates, this is very quick, Paz, but Republican gubernatorial candidate Peter Lumaj came to the U.S. as a refugee from Albania about 30 years ago, said Monday that he rejected an offer from the Trump administration to return as U.S. ambassador to Albania. Really?
That's what he said. I have not been able to confirm that. Mr. Lumaj that night said he didn't want to answer any questions about it. He had to go to another event. He said, call me the next day. I called him the next day. He sent me a text message saying, if I have any questions, I should submit them by email.
So this is all we know. So he believes that perhaps he got an offer to be U.S. ambassador.
He says he was being vetted when he told them thank you, but no thank you, because his wife did not want him to return to Albania.
I have to say, Kevin, you know, we've been maybe complaining over the course of the last couple months that there is not all that much interesting about this gubernatorial campaign. And just within this last week, there's a whole
it's
bunch
a
of,
sudden flurry. I don't expect it will be sustained. But I would say one of the things interesting about Peter Lumaj is I believe he is a really, really committed anti-immigrant right-wing, I would say, kook. He might say something else.
I think it's fair to say he is.
Who practices immigration law, by the
yes,
way.
Yes.
It's kind of an interesting.
It is. The most conservative of the candidates for governor currently.
It is a mishigosh. I mean, I can only imagine what that vetting turned up.
So it's,
once again, ladies and gentlemen, that was Kevin Rennie.
Let's turn to something you wrote about. And here's another candidate, Bob Stefanowski, and the way in which he used social media to criticize. And this is something, obviously, everyone on the Republican side has been trying to outdo each other on, is how can we say bad things about the job that Governor Dan Malloy has done? And I, like, it's fair to say that Governor Malloy's job approval ratings aren't great right now. And
the worst in the country.
The worst in the country. But that having been said, the way in which Stefanowski decided to take jabs at Malloy is something you took issue with. Can we just
wrong.
Talk about this?
Just wrong.
So what did he do?
He used a photo of the governor wiping away a tear when he spoke to the press shortly after the Sandy Hook killings. And it's just wrong. Just wrong.
And
it was from the Wall Street Journal, and yep. It tells us much more about Bob Stefanowski than it does about Governor Malloy. I mean, that was a terrible time. The governor rose to the occasion. Look, we all know he's been a terrible governor. But for that week, in those days, he did what a governor was supposed to do.
But can we play this out a little bit more, though, in terms of the way that Republican candidates might draw a line in terms of how strongly they criticize this governor who's so incredibly unpopular? It's not just about that. I think we can all agree that anything having to do with criticizing the governor's performance around Sandy Hook or drawing some sort of a parallel to it, I mean, it's just wrong on a million different levels that we can't even quantify. But how much value do Republican candidates get out of bashing a guy who's so far down, who's a lame duck governor? I don't know.
It probably helps them in this nominating process where they're trying to differentiate themselves, and that's a common it makes a connection with the people whose support they're seeking. But, you know, Susan Bicewicz went to some effort to point out that she did not spend 1 minute in the Malloy administration. So there, you know, the other day, poor Luke Bronin had to say, oh, I was against the latest CBAC agreement. Well, if he was at the time, he certainly kept it to himself.
He was against the 10-year extension.
Right, the 10-year extension.
I don't know, Danielle, is it everyone just running against Governor Malloy at this point, Republican and Democrat?
Except for the Democrats who are running against Trump.
Right.
I mean, so it's sort of like pick your demon. That picture, I believe, has been used before, or a similar one. Maybe House Republicans at one point during the budget, Sam Delcito or some people like that maybe have put it out on social media as well and had to pull it back. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I could be wrong.
That was the one that I had. I couldn't find other examples.
Yeah.
That was bad enough.
I mean, at this point in the campaign, you know, as Kevin noted earlier, they are speaking to a small universe of potential delegates and some donors. And at the event I went to last night, one of the questions that one of the Republicans asked, what's the one thing that you would say Governor Malloy did right? And the response was visceral. And, you know, I think Pete LaMage said, I'm a little unclear on which one, but somebody said the best thing he did was to announce he's not running again. And that got a huge applause line. And it went down the line and everybody just heaped onto Malloy. And then they got to Stephen Obsitnik, who said, well, wait a minute. I think there was a lot to admire about his response after Sandy Hook. And then one of the other candidates, Mike Handler, actually applauded. And the audience just kind of cooled off a little bit and there was a smattering of applause, I would say. But it is, at this point in the campaign, it's a great line for Republicans. It says something to the base. And the question is going forward, you know, who dominates? Malloy, who does not tweet, or Trump, who does tweet?
Yeah, well—
I think Steve Obsitnik is setting himself apart as a good and decent person, just generally. I have no way to judge what kind of governor these people would be, but I think we start with the basics.
I wanted to use this this opportunity to talk about another event that I know you were at PAS last Friday night. I hosted the Connecticut Forum, which was about journalism and the state of the news, Joy Reid from MSNBC, and the great Washington Post reporter David Fahrenthold and Hugh Hewitt, who is a conservative talk show host, also has a show on MSNBC. He took a little bit of a jab at Governor Malloy on stage, talking about how he is the most unpopular governor in America, or one of, and I agreed with him. And the point—
No, you corrected him and said, it was the most unpopular.
The most unpopular governor. The point he was trying to make, though, is that national media, which is what we spent a lot of time talking about, tends to hold up Malloy as a kind of voice of the party when locally he is so unpopular. And as I thought about it, I honestly thought, Paz, I could have pushed back on Mr. Hewitt a bit more. And I will say I want to apologize to the governor for not pushing back a bit more on that, because I don't think that your ability to stand up, for instance, for what you believe is right in gun legislation should have anything to do with your approval rating and how people feel you've done other parts of your job. I was trying to move the conversation a bit more back to journalism, but I felt since that night that perhaps that was a jab at the governor that could have been better addressed.
It could have been quickly addressed in this sense. Mr. Hewitt suggested that Mr. Hewitt very accurately described the fiscal state of Connecticut and talked about the unfunded pension liability, which we know is really the—
And he said nobody ever talks about that. And I'm like, listen to the Wheelhouse on
yes.
Wednesday mornings. But
well,
anyway.
Yeah, I wanted to throw something at that point, but it was kind of fun. But the impression he gave is that this problem blossomed suddenly with the election of Dan Malloy. And, you know, the one fiscal nod you can give to this governor is he's the governor under whose administration the state has paid into the pension fund the way you're supposed to pay into it. So, yes, there's plenty to talk about the governor's fiscal stewardship of Connecticut. But on that issue, certainly, the unfunded pension liability was here when Governor Malloy arrived, and yes, it will still be here when he exits.
I was there too, and I was really annoyed by his comment, because he seemed to, if I remember correctly, he seemed to sort of imply that reporters need to point out in every story that he's the most unpopular governor in the country, which, you know, seems kind of silly. And then he also said something about Malloy being incompetent. And I think, you know, you can say he's unpopular, you can say he's mishandled certain things, but I don't think incompetent is the first word that comes to mind. So I felt like this is a guy from Washington who really, you know, hadn't done his homework and didn't really understand what was going on in this state. And, you know, he sort of was implying nobody's writing about the pension, you know, crisis and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, dude, come on, you know.
He was doing what he criticizes
exactly,
other journalists.
Exactly, sure. Exactly.
I would, you know, they don't do full biographies when they do these comments about any governor. But I do think we have to remember in 2014, Dan Malloy squeaked home to a second term in part by saying there are no more deficits. And a month and a half later, his administration was announcing we are in a permanent fiscal crisis. That didn't happen in 6 weeks. And he did not tell the truth in order to get reelected in a way far, I think, far more significant than most candidates don't tell the truth. Mm-hmm. I think it was much more fundamental and important than the usual.
He and Tom Foley agreed there was no problem, because if there was a problem, you'd have to
explain
say
what it was, what you're going to do with it.
So there was, yes, the conspiracy of silence.
But Dan Malloy was.
That's a fair criticism.
He was.
Hugh Hewitt, though, was talking about the unfunded pension liability, and that was just crap, that the media is not covering it, and that it was Dan Malloy's fault.
Well, and I think a larger point to our conversation that night was that local reporters and statewide reporters who actually cover issues probably are going to do a better job than national reporters who swoop in and talk about things periodically based on what they may have seen in their morning news feed. Let's go to
Can we say one thing about – do we have one second about Hugh Hewitt? I don't listen to his program, but I do recall in an early presidential debate in 2016, he said to Donald Trump – which part of the nuclear triad would you address first? And it was a brilliant moment that the world should have taken more note of. It was clear Donald Trump had no idea what the nuclear triad was and therefore should not have continued in the race. And Marco Rubio, after the Trump's crazy-ass answer, said, well, for the audience at home that may not understand all the – let me explain what the nuclear triad is.
I will say in preparation for that, I did watch an awful lot of Hugh Hewitt versus Donald Trump, which was a pretty good television program for a bit, and he did do a good job in those debates. I want to move on to some Democratic candidates and a couple things. Here's one that all of us kind of looked at, and it's a – I don't know. It's a political gaffe, Daniela, but sort of one that – I don't know if it speaks to some of the bad luck that Susan Bicewitz has had in her political career. Nationally known political operative Joe Trippi has apologized to Bicewitz's gubernatorial campaign for mistakenly saying that she had served in the U.S. Congress. So some media went out that said, you know, she served as a congresswoman. Oops. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of blamed it on a staffer, a glitch. You know, who knows? I mean, I don't know. Is it part of some larger problem with her campaign? You know, there was also the glitch where she showed up to the wrong office when she was first filing her papers to run. I mean, you know, I don't know.
As the former Secretary of State.
Yeah. How important are these things? I don't know.
I don't know, Paz. How important are these things then? How important are these things to a candidate who has had this sort of stop and start political career with lots of sort of unforced errors like this one?
They're not important unless they feed into a narrative about somebody who is constantly exaggerating. And there's plenty of issues, I think, about, you know, Susan Bicewitz. She's had her up and down career, but I'm not sure that's one of them. So yeah, this was just a screw up. These things happen. You know, I think the Linda McMahon campaign had a picture of a sunrise that turned out to be a sunset, and it was like a thing on social media for a day. And it was like, really? Who cares? You know, some staffer screwed up with a stock photo. Joe Trippi screwed up with, or one of his people screwed up with a social media ad. But that's not going to be the issue.
It's
about
a little glimpse. I put it out there. It's a little glimpse of you know, a modern campaign. You know, there are probably people who pay attention to us are more interested in that than maybe the wider public. But there are little moments. I mean, of much more significance, it seems, is not getting as much attention as the fact that she's completely illiterate when it comes to tolls and infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, saying for weeks and weeks that she wanted to raise $3 billion a year in tolls, which would be – you cannot imagine what that would cost Connecticut drivers. But she kept repeating it and now has backed off a little bit. But it's just one more sign. These people don't really give much thought to issues and the details.
One little detail you wrote about this past week, Kevin, it is coming from this kind of really a dark horse gubernatorial candidate who's not going to be able to take part in the citizens' election program. The mayor of Bridgeport, Joe Ganim, he brings up an issue that I don't know. Nobody else is really bringing up, referring to dozens of town committee forums around the state. I'm quoting here from your blog what Ganim said. It's obvious to any observer that those in attendance at these forums are almost all white, even though almost 33% of Connecticut residents are black or Latino. Joe Ganim's making a case that the Democratic Party and its forums, it needs to, I don't know, look a little bit more like Connecticut. I don't know. This isn't a bad way to set yourself apart, I suppose, if you're Joe Ganim.
Well, it is. But, you know, if you look at the cities in Connecticut, three largest cities, four largest cities, have very significant minority populations, and you know, a lot of their political leaders are white. You know, Hartford has a white mayor. Bridgeport has Joe Ganim, a white mayor. They have their some of the, you know, their legislative delegation is more diverse, but. Probably, and there's city councils, but you know, three of the four largest cities are white men. So
Joe Ganim's letter. The timing was interesting because he had a very, very bad time at a forum in Fairfield where there were two party officials. One is a woman named Melissa Kane. She used to be the Democratic town chair of Westport. She's on the board of selectmen there. And the questions that they posed to the candidates, her and
Steve Sheinberg, who's the chair of Fairfield. They were really pushing these candidates to prove how are you electable. And in the case of Mr. Ghanem, who served 7 years in prison, I mean, this is a very relevant question. So I think, you know, Canham's feeling a little put upon, I think, at some of these things. And one of the questions she posed to him was at the end, because he didn't really address his electability, she said, I'm going to ask all of you to identify your Achilles heels. And if you can't think of one, she said, you all have one, and we are here to jog your memory. And then when it was turned for Mr. Ghanem to answer, she said, Mr. Ghanem, your Achilles heel. And the crowd laughed. So that's, I think, a little bit of the context for that letter, that Mr. Ghanem has perhaps been feel a little misused at some of the suburban forums.
Yeah. I don't know, Danielle. I mean, Joe Ghanem is a different sort of candidate, and I don't know how he is – Paz just gave a good example – how he is showing up and how other Democrats are treating him on this campaign trail that is different. I don't know if this portends any particular path for the mayor who has made this big political comeback from being in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what the point was of putting out that press release. I know, you know, just making a few calls following that. There are forums planned. The Connecticut Democratic Hispanic Caucus is going to be having all kinds of forums with, you know, candidates up and down the slate. So I wasn't quite sure what his point was. I mean, and again, you know, to Kevin's point, you might look at, you know, forget about who's in the audience. How about who's on the slate? I mean, you know, all the gubernatorial candidates are white men except for Susan Bisewitz, who's a white woman. You know, where's the diversity there? I mean, we're just going through a time, you know, in this country, Black Lives Matter and, you know, the Trump backlash. And there's a lot happening. And yet, you know, the folks who the Democrats are putting up running for office are largely the same folks that you would have seen in, you know, 1978.
Well, I want to take a break. When we come back,
that's right.
let's talk briefly about why it seems that the Republican Party doesn't really want to run any competitive races for Congress. This has been a problem in the state for quite a number of years, and it's really interesting in the context of what's going on in some other states. We're talking with Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Courant, Kevin Rennie, also from the Hartford Courant, who blogs at dailyructions.com, and Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Mark Pazniokas from ctmirror.org, Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Courant, and Kevin Rennie, who blogs at dailyructions.com.
Republicans in Pennsylvania suffered critical losses today in a long-running congressional redistricting fight. Both the U.S. Supreme Court and a panel of federal judges refused their request to block a newly drawn map deemed more fair and more favorable to Democrats.
That's PBS reporting on the second big defeat for Republicans in my home state of Pennsylvania after losing a very tight special election in the old 18th congressional district that is shaped currently like a T-Rex bending over to take a drink of water. They've lost a battle to retain these oddly shaped, wildly gerrymandered districts. Now, in Connecticut, we don't really have to worry about some of these problems in large part because I know we've seemingly given up on the idea of our congressional campaigns being competitive at all. I want to just talk through these things with you folks. Danielle, I'll start with you. Republicans in the state of Connecticut have made great headway toward balancing out the state legislature, and we've seen the results of that at the state capitol this past year. Clearly, they have a lot of people who want to jump into the race to be governor of Connecticut. With all of this, I'm not still quite sure why there's not attempts to be more competitive in the five congressional districts, especially given all of the wild swings in politics in all these other states and the reality that you can probably be competitive in some of these places if you just put in some effort.
Yeah, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of effort being put in. A lot of reasons. I mean, you know, first off, everybody wants to run for governor because you get, you know, taxpayer money to do it. And nobody's giving you money to run for Congress. So that's one thing. And it's a slog.
But it's a really lousy job if you get it.
True. It's a hard job.
But you get a house near the office, which you don't get in Congress.
That is true. You don't get a house. Yeah, but anyway, yes.
And, you know, secondly, I mean, in terms of the way the districts are drawn, but, you know, you'd certainly think, you know, perhaps the second congressional district where Republicans have been gaining ground or, you know, maybe even the fifth district. there might be incentive for the Republicans to run there. No one wants to run against Joe Courtney, so that takes the second off the table. And then as far as, you know, the fifth, there are a couple of candidates there. But I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons why Republicans seem to have focused their efforts and energy elsewhere. Also, 2018, you know, there's going to be a lot of we're seeing that now with some of these special elections. It's going to be a tough year, as it always is, the midterm for any president in power. Trump brings additional, you know, challenges, I think, for Republican candidates. So, you know, this year in particular will be hard, I think.
But and as much as people are going to be running against Donald Trump in all the congressional races across America, Paz, there also is something, and this is one of the things we talked about at the forum that night, too. I mean, whenever you have any state that is so reliably red or blue that you have such party control, midterms are often the place in which, you know, people want to speak up against power and the power structure that is currently in place. It's why people are able to run against Governor Malloy. I don't know that even with an anti-Trump wave, that there's not some potential to be able to push back against a state that has all of its statewide elected officials being Democrat and all of its congressional folks as well.
2016 was the year that the Republicans seemed to throw in the towel on congressional races. For the first time, there was not a single for the first time since the Republicans lost the three. Remember, it wasn't that long ago. The Republicans held three of the five U.S. House seats in Connecticut. They lost two of them in 2006 and the last one in 2008. But 2016 was a turning point in the sense that it was the first time since they lost those seats that there was no Republican who came close to raising $1 million. It was just an awful year. It's not drawing the fields that you would think. I mean, on paper, the 5th district is an absolutely competitive district. And if you look at how Republican candidates for U.S. Senate, for governor, how they do in the 5th district, should be a battleground. 2nd district, Danielle is absolutely right. The numbers actually a little bit better for Democrats, but there is a trend. I mean, Eastern Connecticut, there's certainly these very conservative pockets. And, before Joe Courtney held it, you know, you had Rob Simmons who was in for a few terms. So, and then the 4th district, you know, why Republicans can't compete there, you know, is kind of a mystery. You know, Jim Himes wins based on the virtue of the returns in two or three of the 17 communities.
Yeah. Kevin, I mean, why can't Republicans put up a fight?
Well, the potential candidates, mostly legislators, senators and state representatives, they don't want to risk – they don't want to give up their seats for a losing race. It costs millions of dollars. They saw the last, I'd say, really serious campaign, that textbook campaign was 2012 with Andrew Rohrbach running again in the open seat against Elizabeth Esty. He ran a good campaign, and he lost. I mean, he didn't lose by just a little bit either. And
presidential year, that didn't
presidential
help.
Year. Yeah. It's hard. So you know, even if you, let's say you were to win in an off year, which is not going to happen this year, you then face the challenge of the presidential year just 2 years after that. And you know, there's one Republican in Congress from New England. That's in northern Maine. Voters in the North, you know, they'll elect you as governor, but they don't want to send Republicans to Washington to be with those awful Republicans from other parts of the nation who are different, who are very different.
So does it change any time in the next several cycles, Danielle, or is this what we're stuck with?
Who knows? No one has a crystal ball. I do think Kevin's right, though, that sort of model for the, you know, New England Republican, that sort of moderate, you know, the Saltonstalls and the, you know, Governor Weld and people like that, you know, they just don't have a place in the congressional races anymore. There's no opening for them.
Daniela Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Courant. Daniela, always good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Kevin Rennie. He's a lawyer. He's a Hartford Courant columnist, and he blogs at dailyructions.com. Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Mark Pazniokas, because he's Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks so much, Paz.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Scott Breedy. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Kyle Wolf is our technical producer. Thanks to intern Garnet McLaughlin and also Betsy Kaplan for helping with today's show. This is The Wheelhouse.